Welcome back. It's the third hour of Issues Etc., but we're halfway through an hour of open lines, 25 minutes of open lines ahead, and then in the last 25 minutes of the program, Marcia Montenegro joins us to talk about the book Conversations with God for Teens. It follows up on Neil Donald Walsh's book Conversations with God. He claims to have heard from God, and God is giving advice to teens. Now, Marcia Montenegro is founder of Christian Answers for the New Age, based in Arlington, Virginia. That'll round off the program for today. Now, what do you think about this controversy surrounding the male-only membership at Augusta National Golf Club in Georgia? It's a private club. It's prestigious. It's on television now because, of course, the Masters are being broadcast internationally. Give me a call in the next 25 minutes. The phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd also like your reaction to this. This is connected in a certain way. From Baptist Press, headline, "Do you want your church to grow? Bring in the men." It's by Paulie House. Did you know that if a child is the first person in the household to become a Christian, there's a 3.5% probability everyone else in the house will follow? If the mother is the first to become a Christian, there's a 17% probability that everyone else in the house will follow. But if the father is first, there's a 93% probability that everyone else in the household will follow. These statistics, Sid Woodruff, men's ministry specialist, said, shout the importance of churches becoming more intentional in their development of ministries for men. Quote, if you reach the men, you reach the families. But to reach men, you have to enter into their world. Of about the 94 million men in the United States, Woodruff said, 68 million don't attend any church, but 85% of those say that they did grow up with some sort of church background. These men aren't necessarily opposed to going to church, said Woodruff. They just don't see churches as being male-friendly. Why are churches not male-friendly, or at least perceived as not being male-friendly? Why are men reluctant to attend church? Those are the questions for you. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The best caller during this half hour of Issues Etc. open lines will receive the book called The Church Impotent by Dr. Leon Pottles. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon. Going back to Phyllis Schlafly's remarks about the First Amendment, the freedom of association that we have, I agree with that, and that is one point that I have not heard made by anyone else. It's a very good point. And as far as the feminists or people who are stirring this controversy up, there's a word for them. It's busybodies. And I think it would be neat if they would lose in court and be made to compensate the justice system for time spent and money, taxpayer money wasted.
Bill, before I let you go, I want to ask you this question about the men in church. Why do you think the church men are not going to church? Why are they reluctant to go to church?
Oh, that's a good one. I don't know.
I mean, they're anxious to join golf clubs. There's no doubt about that. And if you got enough money and if you get invited, you can join Augusta. There's no doubt about that. But apparently, according to the statistics, men are rather reluctant. Of the 93 million in America, only 68 million of those don't go to any church whatsoever.
Maybe it's you still there?
Yeah.
Maybe it's because they've been asked to make a decision, and that don't work.
I don't know. I don't think men, thank you very much, Bill, I don't think men have a problem making a decision. Join the NRA. I mean, you actually have to check the box and sign your name and send in a check, and they don't have a problem making that decision. They don't have a problem making a lot of decisions. I imagine it's a pretty weighty decision to sit down and write out a $50,000 check to join Augusta, but there are people in this country who would give their right arm for that opportunity to go and join Augusta, men. So I don't know if it's a decision thing. What about church today is making men reluctant to show up? We've talked about this before. We've talked about the fact that if you look on Sunday morning in the average Christian church in America, the majority of the people sitting in those pews are female. Why is this? 505-750-1-800-730-2727. Mike is calling from his car. Mike, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks. Still there?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to comment on the men in the church issue. I think it goes back to kind of the issue we find ourselves in the church today, and that is that there's very little for men. Most of the ministry that goes on in church today is focused on children and women. And it seems that the New Testament pattern is the other way around, that most ministry was based on the, directed towards the men. And then the understanding was that the men would then take care of the women and the children, that the husbands taught their wives at home and they taught their children. Fathers, you know, train your children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And wives, if you have a question, ask your husbands when you get home. I mean, that was kind of the understanding in the New Testament and church. And, of course, we've gotten off base with that, with all the focus off of them and on the women. So it's almost like, and it's had the effect that it's made them irrelevant, because now the church takes care of the responsibilities that they've been given. And so now they don't have a role. They don't, not only do they not have ministry focused on them, but they don't have a role anymore. They don't have anything to do in regards to their family. So they don't feel a need to be responsible to not only train their own children, their own families, but then to be responsible to bringing them to church, to be the one that takes up that main part of that responsibility. So it just seems to me that the church has kind of made them irrelevant, and so that's why we're seeing, I think anyway, that's why we're seeing a lack of them. I think we need to return to the biblical pattern, which is that churches need to focus on men and then encourage those men to focus on their families, focus on their wives and their children.
Mike, why do you think that the church has focused on women more than men? What do you think's behind that?
I don't know really what's behind that. I mean, historically, that's kind of just where we've progressed or digressed, whichever way you look at it, and that's kind of where we're at today. I'm not really sure what brought that on. If it was men, you know, the Industrial Revolution and men leaving the home, and or if there was some other factor involved in it, I'm not really sure what happened there. But I think it needs to change. I think we need to go back to the pattern of focusing on men. However we got here, I think we need to undo that and return back to the biblical pattern. You don't really find that in the New Testament. I mean, there's no mention of any kind of children's ministry or women's ministry in the New Testament. It all is focused on men. And you know, if we want to be a biblical people, it would seem to me that we'd want to go back to that and look and see how they did it. And that's I don't know. That seems only a return to that is going to cause men to once again be brought back into the picture. I mean, I know the church I attend, there was heavily a lot of youth ministry and a lot of women's ministries, and there's very little for men. We have a men's prayer breakfast, and that's just about it.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate the call. Now, I think he's rightly diagnosed, at least in the broad outline, what the dilemma is, why men feel reluctant to go to church. He's simply said they seem superfluous there. The church is taking care of the responsibility that perhaps in the past the church would have given to the men, that is to be the spiritual head of the family, to instruct their wife and their children. You know, interesting, he mentioned that passage that says, women, if you want to know something, ask your husband at home. That's almost been flip-flopped today, to where men, if you want to know something, just ask your wife when you get home. If you don't understand this man in the sermon, ask your wife. She understands it. It seems to have almost been flip-flopped. Our phone numbers are 505-750-1-800-730-2727. Calling from her car. Sally's on the line. Sally, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd.
Hello.
I have a different, another view of what's causing men to not be as active in the church, and probably will make a lot of women angry, but I really think, like in the Lutheran church, women's suffrage coming to play in the immediate runnings of the church has pushed men out of the church. I know in several congregations I've been in, the one that I was in that didn't have women's suffrage, we had a lot higher percentage of active men in the church and taking leadership roles. And then the next congregation I went to, we didn't have women's suffrage, or we did have women's suffrage. And I think men don't want to come up against somebody else's wife in a meeting, or mother or sister. And so they just kind of start pulling back and not filling positions. And the more they do that, the more they pull back away from the church and leave everything up to the women to do. I think they don't know what their role is anymore. And I think some of that comes from the 60s movement and feminism, as it adds to what your previous caller said about men feeling obsolete, but I think part of it is the fact that they don't know what they're supposed to do anymore. It's kind of like the man who opens the door for you. He doesn't know if he's going to get yelled at or if he's going to be thanked. So they just don't do anything then. It's safer.
Sally, thank you so much for the call. Sheila's calling from her car. Sheila, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I was also triggered as I just got off work from the caller previous to Sally. And it's the lack of men in the church. I don't see it as much in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because they are the elders and everything. But there are a lot of men that weren't raised in those biblical standards in their home, and they leave the home. So then the woman is then responsible for those upbringings of those children.
Well, now that might be true in some cases, but according to the statistics that I have before me,
mm-hmm.
Okay, here they are again for everybody. There are 94 million men in the United States, roughly. 68 million of those don't attend any church, and yet of those 68 million that don't attend any church, 85% of them said that they did grow up with a church background.
Wow.
So it is not that they weren't raised this way. I could understand, you know, that a certain percentage of this is going to be that they weren't raised in the church and therefore they have no use for it in their adult life. But of those who were raised in it and then now are not attending any church, the question that is raised by those who have put together this set of statistics is,
mm-hmm.
why is the church not viewed by men as male-friendly? Sheila, thank you so much for the call. Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Regarding men's role in the church, I don't think it's just one issue, but I think part of it is the fact that the church has stopped teaching the deep things of God. I think we've gotten away from teaching theology, teaching doctrine, and I think that we're in this seeker-sensitive movement, which I think plays on the emotions, and I think we've gotten away from that, and I think that is one contributing factor to it.
So in other words, what, lack of substance?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, teach Jesus loves you, this I know, which is true, but, you know, there's a lot more than that. There's a, you know, yeah, lack of substance, and I think we've gotten away from that.
Jeff, thank you very much. By the way, folks, I will have some thoughts on this before we end this half hour of Issues Etc. Open Lines. Let's go next to Carl, who's calling from St. Louis. Thank you for waiting, Carl, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Hi.
It seems to be a kind of a combination of things. This feminization movement has caused women to be more masculine, has caused men to be more feminine, and your previous caller there about not teaching good doctrine within the church. Women are not good men. Men are not good women. And that's caused this whole thing where men just don't know where they fit in. And frankly, why should they fight their women? Because then they're going to get it at home if they don't go along with the whole thing. So they just go right along with this whole thing and let it ride, not causing problems.
Carl, thank you very much. You know, let's see. Sally had mentioned women's suffrage, women having a vote in the voters' assemblies of congregations. And I've often pointed out on the air, regardless of where you stand on that particular issue, that even when women didn't have the vote, they did have a vote indirectly through their husbands. In fact, I imagine it was often the case when only men voted in voters' assemblies and congregations that the smart man would check with his wife before he went in and cast his vote. Not in every case, of course, but that's just one of those things that is... But when a man has the prospect of having these roles taken away from him, several of the callers have said men don't know where they fit in. That's an interesting diagnosis. Men don't know where they fit in. And I wonder why that is. That's just another way of saying men do not find the church to be male-friendly. Now, that's kind of a wimpy way of saying it, male-friendly. Is it that they don't know where they fit in, or is it they just simply don't think they do, period? I don't fit there. It's not that when I go there, I have to wander around saying, where do I fit? Is it that men are saying, that is not the place for me? But it still doesn't answer the question of why have they drawn that conclusion. Let's talk with Jonathan calling from St. Louis. Jonathan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi there. I think feminism has given men just the excuse they need to be what they normally and naturally want to be as sinful and fallen creatures. We don't want to be in church. We hate God. We hate everything to do with him. And for years we've had the church telling us, be a good husband, be a good father, and Jesus Christ, by the way, saves you. And now we've gotten to this point where they're not being told that anymore by the society. They don't know where they fit in. And so naturally, why are they going to in any way have anything to do with a church which is just going to tell them Jesus Christ saves them? That's the last thing that we want to hear as sinful men.
So in other words, connect those dots one more time for me. What's missing?
What's missing? I wish I could connect it better, because it does seem kind of vague.
Well, I don't think you're vague. I just lost you somewhere in between. I just think I had a brain freeze for a second. What is missing that wherein men say that's not the place for me?
Gosh, their role as husband and father, and as sinful man, their role as a sinner who is cannot free himself. The guy mentioned doctrine before. We're not really being told that anymore, that we can't free ourselves. And it comes back to Christ, and our hate for Christ is what keeps men out of the church. That's why 85% of men aren't going to churches, because they don't love God. It's not what we do.
Jonathan, thank you very much. I think there's an insight in there that is worthy of repetition. I just have to make a note here in order to come back to that. Matilda is on the line. Matilda, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
I have a poem that I'm certain the feminists would not agree with, but I would like to read it to you. It's entitled, Women's Rights. The rights of women, what are they? The right to labor, love, and pray. The right to weep when others weep. The right to wake when others sleep. The right to dry the falling tear. The right to quell the rising fear. The right to smooth the brow of care and whisper comfort to despair. The right to watch the parting breath and soothe and cheer the bed of death. The right, when earthly hopes all fail, to point to that within the veil. The right the wanderer to reclaim and win the lost from paths of shame. The right to comfort and to bless the widow and the fatherless. The right the little ones to guide in simple faith to him who died, with earnest love and gentle praise to bless and cheer their youthful days. The right to live for those we love. The right to die, that love to prove. The right to brighten earthly homes with pleasant smile and gentle tones. Are these thy rights? Then use them well. Thy silent influence none can tell. If these are thine, why ask for more? Thou hast enough to answer for. And I think I probably got that out of either the Waffle League Messenger or the Lutheran Witness back probably in the late 1940s.
Matilda, thank you very much. That is marvelous. That is marvelous. So we're trying to hone in on this question. I think now Matilda has added another wrinkle here, and that is that alongside the fact that men in some way feel excluded from the life of the church, can we conclude that? They come to church and they say, this isn't the place for me, or there is no place for me here. What has also been told to women? Have they been given things to do? Have they been given a role by the church today that is not properly theirs? I think there's more than one thing happening here. And what we need to sort out is, what is the main cause? There is no doubt whatsoever. No doubt whatsoever. It has been diagnosed in this book, and I will give this away here before the hour ends. It has been diagnosed in this book called The Church Impotent by Dr. Leon Pottles. But this is a problem going back, he says, 1,000 years in the life of the church. 1,000 years in the life of the church. The feminization of the church. But what does that mean? See, even before there was feminism, there was a problem here. There were men less and less in church, women more and more in church. Now, if you're the big church growther, and you're looking for that silver bullet that will grow your church, the Baptist Press says, bring in the men. Because you bring in a man, a father, and a husband, there is a 93% chance that the rest of the family will follow. If you bring in the mother, there's only a 17% chance you'll get anyone else in the family. You bring in the children, we were talking about, oh, if we bring in the kids, then the parents will come. There's only a 3.5% chance that the rest of the household will follow if you bring in the kids. But a 93% chance that the rest of the household will follow dad and husband into church. So if you're looking for that silver bullet, you want to bring in men. But how are you going to do that? Are you going to do that by accommodating the message to the culture? Speaking as a man, men see through this. Are you going to do that by softening the message so that massaging the message so that it's more palatable to men? Somebody called earlier and said maybe the problem is men aren't being asked to make a decision, or maybe it's too hard for them to make a decision. I think part of the problem is, and I think Jonathan brought this up, by the way, when he called. He didn't put it in these terms, but this is what he was saying. He was saying men stay away from church because they're sinners. What are they not hearing in church today when they walk into church? Oh, they're hearing Jesus loves you, this I know. Or God is so good. Maybe are they being turned off by a feminized Jesus? A Jesus with no hard edges. A Jesus that says to men, you know, all you need is a little self-improvement and you can achieve it with my advice. Just follow my ways and you can achieve it. It's that little engine that could theology. I think I can, I think I can. A man walks in there and, you know, men, I'll speak as a man. Men are very good at cutting through the crap. And they look at that and they say, no, I can't. I mean, only men who delude themselves say they think they can. Men know what they can and can't do. And there's a lot of bravado there, but beneath it, there's a practicality that says, either I can or I can't. And here I walk into church, and this Jesus and this pastor and this congregation and this message is telling me that all I need is a little self-improvement. Men know better. Maybe they need the hard word of the law first, that affirms for them what they already know deep in their hearts as the sinners they are. Yeah, you're a sinner, man. We know what dwells in your heart. We know how dark and deep it is there. And we know what kind of filth comes out of the human heart, just as Jesus says. And you can't do it. You can't improve yourself. There's nothing you can do. This is one job you can't tackle. This is one thing you're incapable of doing. And that is making yourself any better before God. The law that you hear in this church will leave you dead. You know, I think men might perk up their ears to hear a message like that, rather than, come on in and we'll help you improve yourself with some helpful advice from Jesus, who has no hard edges and just gives that kind of advice so you can do it on your own. Men don't need I think I can theology. What men need is a pure teaching first of the law that says you can't and you never will, but Jesus has. To be shown a real man there on the cross. Think about this for a second. A real man who did, who could, who can, who did, and who didn't just come to give us advice. He came to actually pay the price. What is it that appeals to us about these men who stand on the battlefield and actually sacrifice? What appeals to us as men is that same thing that should appeal about Christ. He actually did for us what we could not do ourselves at the cross.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Children love stories, especially stories that are true. The greatest story you can tell your children is found in the Issues, etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter. In this book, Dr. Paul Meyer vividly retells the story of Jesus' betrayal, his passion, his trials, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. It's the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Very First Easter. You can order this book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on The Very First Easter. You can also order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. or go to our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
Marry your relative. Now, can you?
Answers with Ken Ham, an editor of the family magazine called Creation. Well, Ken, are you suggesting that it's possible to marry a relative?
I was speaking to a large group of pastors, and I asked them if they would perform a marriage ceremony if the two people were related. Quite a lot of the pastors said, no, we wouldn't. But wait a minute, I said, if you don't marry your relative, then what do you marry? The reason I ask this trick question has to do with the fact that all human beings go back to one man and one woman, Adam and Eve. That's why Paul in Acts 17 said we're all of one blood. In other words, we are all related. That's why Jesus Christ's death on the cross can save the descendants of Adam, because we're all related. So if you don't marry your relative, then you're not marrying a human being. Then you're really in trouble. These days, we know that you shouldn't marry someone who's closely related because of all the mistakes in our genetic code that we've passed on to our children. Nevertheless, your spouse was related to you before you got married. We're all descendants of one man and one woman, and therefore related to each other.
Did God create Adam in the same week that he also created the animals, or did creation take place over millions of years? Our new booklet, written by Ken Ham, is available free on our website, and it tackles that key question. Read the booklet at AnswersRadio.com. It's our attractive and easy-to-use website. So next time you're at your computer, go to AnswersRadio.com.
:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, mostly clear, overnight low of about 35. For tomorrow, sunny and a high near 64. Right now, scattered clouds and 51 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 is heavy and slow from the Science Center to an accident blocking the right lane east of Laclede Station Road. Also slow 270 to Maryville. Southbound 270 between Ladue Road and 40, slow traffic in pockets to Doherty Ferry. Westbound 44 between 270 and Merrimack River Bridge, slow traffic there. Northbound 55 at Park Avenue, slow traffic in the right lane to the Poplar Street Bridge. And eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, heavy traffic there. The topic for the remaining 30 minutes of Issues Etc. is the book Conversations with God for Teens, and Pastor Todd will talk with a former astrologist about that.
Messiah Lutheran, a church and school for all nations, located on South Grand across from Tower Grove Park, worships at 8 and 10:30 a.m. on Sunday mornings. Beginning April 13th at 11 a.m., we are adding an urban contemporary worship service, Messiah City Worship, in our school gym. Our city worship will feature sound biblical preaching and contemporary Christian music in a casual and relaxed setting. Call 314-772-4474 for more information about the ministries of Messiah.
Welcome back for the last half hour of Issues Etc. today. Before I forget, from the last hour I did promise to give the best caller, and this was a tough call because there were a lot of good callers in the last hour of Open Lines Issues Etc., but I did promise to give one of them a copy of Dr. Leon Poddle's book called The Church Impotent: The Feminization of Christianity. It's a fantastic book. I think that I've got to go with Jonathan if he could call back. If Jonathan would call back, and it's 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jeff will get your name and address, and we will send you a free copy of The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity by Dr. Leon Poddles. Friday on the program, Men Want Substance, Listen to Issues, Etc. Friday on the program. We'll start out with the hymn study of the hymn Stricken, Smitten, and Afflicted. Now, there is a Jesus with some sharp edges on him. Pastor Henry Gericke of the Concordia Seminary Chorus joins us to talk about that hymn. Also, the humiliation of Christ. Dr. Robert Kolb of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis joins us, and we'll round it off with an hour conversation with Dr. Paul Meyer, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter. We'll talk about the events surrounding the death and resurrection of Christ Friday on Issues Etc. For the last half hour here, we have Marcia Montenegro. She's a former astrologist, founder of Christian Answers for the New Age, based in Arlington, Virginia, and author of an article in the latest edition of the Midwest Christian Outreach Journal titled, Don't Talk to Strangers. We're going to talk about Neil Donald Walsh's new book, Conversations with God for Teens. Marcia, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about this for teens book, give us just the broadest outline of the book that launched this for Neil Donald Walsh called Conversations with God. What was he purporting to have recorded in this popular book?
Right. In his first book, Conversations with God, book one, he claimed that as he was struggling in a crisis and had questions about what was going on in his life, he was writing things out, and suddenly he said the pen started to more or less write by itself and give answers to his questions. And he claims that God was answering his questions. And so he continued to ask questions, and he claims that God was answering them, and he put that in a book, Conversations with God, and followed it with two other books, Conversations with God, Book 2 and Book 3, and then further books like Friendship with God and Communion with God with the same kind of format.
So he claims to be receiving, in essence, direct, unmediated inspiration from God, revelation and communication from God.
Yes, absolutely. He does claim this.
And this Conversations with God for Teens, does it follow the same format, the same claim?
It's a little different in that he gathered questions from teens on a website, to questions that just teens have about life and what they should do and problems with parents, etc. And he then put these questions to God, according to him, and got answers to these questions, which he wrote out in this book, Conversations with God for Teens. So that's what he's claiming in this book. In most of the cases, there are follow-up questions, but he says he wrote most of the follow-up questions that he thought maybe the teens would ask. Only in a few cases did teens have a chance to write any follow-up questions.
Now,
we don't really know what they thought of the question, of the answers.
Who does Neil Donald Walsh claim this God is with whom he claims to communicate?
It's just that it's God. He doesn't make any really independent statements so much as he lets this God reveal things about himself. And he sometimes objects or makes certain statements like, oh, how could that be? And then this God who's talking to him will say, yeah, you were all wrong. That's not who I really am. And what you come out with is a God that is revealing himself as somebody who does not believe there is absolute right or wrong, who does not care what we do, who is against any kind of judgment or condemnation of anything or anyone, and who says our main purpose is to remember who we are, which is that we came from God. Those are major themes.
I guess the simplest question at this point is, in your estimation, Marcia, is Neil Donald Walsh hearing from God, the true God?
Well, of course, as a Christian, it's very easy to see that this God contradicts the God of the Bible. But even for non-Christians, if you just take certain basic assumptions that if this truly is God, he should display wisdom, he should display love, he should display concern and intelligence. If you would just assume that, even talking to someone who wasn't a Christian but who believed there was some sort of God, you would probably have people say, yes, I would hope that he displays intelligence and love and wisdom. And just on that basis, you can claim this isn't God, because he contradicts himself in grand ways, not just in little tiny things, but in huge ways that involve the validity of the whole message, and makes all kinds of claims that should bother people, such as, you shouldn't judge or condemn anyone. And one of the questions one of the teens ask is about self-defense. Is war okay? And he says, no, all killing and cruelty is wrong. And then the follow-up question is, but what about defending yourself? And he says, oh, that's killing and cruelty too. And, I mean, he claims, so therefore you're not even supposed to be able to defend yourself. I mean, these things are very extreme.
Okay, so what you're saying here is that if we simply hold this God of Neil Donald Walsh's books to the fundamental things we would expect from any intelligent supreme being.
Right.
And that is logical consistency, moral
right.
consistency. This God doesn't pass the test.
Right. Just basic intelligence and basic caring, because he comes out and says blatantly he doesn't care what we do. And here you have, if you also take some of his ideas and try to see what the implications are, you can see problems. For example, he says, you can't judge or condemn anything. So, you know, you can't judge or condemn anything at all. Well, what is a teen to think of a situation where they're being abused physically or sexually? Or they have a friend who's being abused. According to this God, they can't be in a position to judge or condemn this action as wrong, since there is no such thing as right or wrong, as this God claims. So you basically are put in a position of having to accept things being done that your instinctive reaction is to call them evil or at least unfair or cruel or painful, and yet you are supposed to just accept them, since there is absolutely no condemnation of anything. I mean, he does not give any exceptions for this. Now, the other problem is that, of course, he contradicts himself, because he himself has clear preferences and is against certain things. He's against damage to the environment. He's against hypocrisy. He's against lying. And he's against believing that there's only one way to God, surprisingly. I said that kind of sarcastically. And so he's against certain things, obviously, and yet he says we can't be against anything. I mean, it's just one contradiction after another in throughout this book.
Now, it should be pointed out at this point that when it comes to the Conversations with God series of books by Neil Donald Walsh, and I would assume also with this Conversations with God for Teens book that he's produced, we're not talking about books that are sitting idle on the bookshelves. These things sell, don't they?
Yes, they sell very well. His Conversations with God books actually are part of a study across the country where people meet in homes and use the Conversation with God books as their spiritual guide. They meet weekly or every 2 weeks or whatever, and have discussions about the ideas in these books and using them. I get quite a bit of email, both from Christians who have friends or family members reading these books and are being influenced by them, as well as from people who are ardent fans of these books who are challenging me on my position that I take on the book.
Now, how are they challenging you? Are they saying you're misreading the book, or that you're reading the book rightly, but you're criticizing it wrongly?
They say usually I'm misreading it or taking it out of context, or, you know, I need to read it again. Somehow I'm wrong in my assessment. And, of course, I just tell them, look, I have direct quotes from the book here. You can check out everything I say. I am not at all twisting anything that this God in this book says. I'm just saying exactly what he says. You know, maybe you haven't thought about the implications of these things. And I've had some, you know, back and forth dialogues with a few people trying to defend the books, and they basically can't. I mean, they have to admit the facts, you know, or else they don't admit the facts. But if they admit the facts of the book, there's nowhere to go except the direction I'm going in, because it's just clear. It's very clear. The books aren't, like, written in a difficult way where it's hard to understand what this God is saying. It's very, very upfront. So I may ask somebody, well, you know, this is, look on page such and such. This is where God says that he doesn't care what you do. You know, does that bother you? I mean, this kind of thing. See, they don't want to see what it says because the parts of the book they like are what they're following, and I think they just kind of are in denial about the things, the implications of the negative sides of the book.
I'm curious about this, Marcia. The people who have reacted to your critiques of the conversations with God, first of all, do some of them profess to be Christians? And second of all, do they believe that these are genuine revelations from the true God? Or is this, do they view this as kind of like, well, this is just more something to stimulate discussion? It's not really a true conversation with God, just one man's conception of what it would be like to have a conversation with God.
None of them have told me that they don't think it's from God. I have asked a few of them that, do you really think this is from God? And they haven't said no. Now, they don't always answer my questions, so it's hard sometimes for me to get the, you know, I can't always get the answer that I'm seeking. They may come back and just say something else and not answer my question, but none of them have said, no, it's not from God, because Walsh makes it clear that it's from God. So, you know, unless they believe otherwise, they're not telling me that. They seem to think it's from God. None of them that I can think of have claimed to be a Christian, except maybe one person who said she was a Christian. But a lot of people do claim to be Christian because of their background, even if they really aren't. If they were raised, for example, to believe if you're baptized as a Christian, you're a Christian, that's what makes you a Christian. Or they may think that this is sort of another side of Christianity, you know, because they don't have a view of what authentic Christianity is. But in most cases, they are not making a big claim about being a Christian. They're just thinking that this is spiritual guidance, and it is the best spiritual guidance they have ever seen. I mean, they're very enthused about it.
Okay, who is this God, according to the God who professes to speak through Neil Donald Walsh's book? How would you describe this God?
He seems to be, even though he's speaking to Walsh, which would indicate a personal relationship and a personal God, he seems to be more impersonal, because he claims that he is the only thing that exists, and everything has come out of him. So this is like a kind of a Gnostic God, where he has these emanations that come out of him, a sort of pantheistic God. So he claims to be this God that existed completely just all unto himself, but in order to experience himself, he had to differentiate, and he had to emanate the world and people out of him, so that through other people he would have this vicarious understanding of who he is and what ultimate reality is. Everything is an illusion except for this God. This God is the only reality, and everything that we're living is just an illusion. It's sort of a play that we're in, but it's not actually real, and we're going through this whole process in order to come to understand who we are. It's a very, the setup of it is kind of along the lines of some forms of Hinduism, where we're supposed to believe that this world is illusory and it's not the ultimate reality. So basically, this God is saying, you know, you can't trust your perceptions of reality, because what you think is real is not real, and what really is real is kind of hidden. It's something you have to come to understand. Now, one of the things I ask is, well, if all is an illusion, then how do we know that this God that Walsh is channeling is not an illusion? And, I mean, how are we supposed to measure illusion and reality? If all is illusion, what's the standard for it? To me, this God, the way he reveals himself, is kind of a New Age sort of God. But with actually a lot more problems than the older New Age God that I was familiar with. I mean, I'm not sure what I would have thought of this particular God or these books as a New Ager. There wasn't really anything like this that was out when I was involved in the New Age. The God was very fuzzy, and people didn't really talk about God that much, except in these very vague terms. Everybody was God. We're all going back to God. This guy gets very specific about, you know, how the world was set up, and how we can't trust our perceptions and things like that. So it's kind of a New Age God, but with more specifics.
I'm curious about this. If this God of Neil Donald Walsh's Conversations with God and Conversations with God for Teens books, if he's the only thing that exists, and if we are merely emanations of him so that he can gain a self-understanding, then this God is really, in claiming to have a conversation with Neil Donald Walsh, having a conversation with himself, isn't he?
Well, yeah, in a way, yeah, because we're really a part of God, and he says when we die, we're gonna go back to this God for a while, and then we go out again to be born, and so we merge with God, we meld. I think he uses the word meld with him. Then we go out again. So yeah, we are really God, and we really are part of this God because we came from this God. So our individual identities are not actual, and you know, that's another troubling aspect of it. And that means everybody goes to God. I mean, Hitler, you know, anybody, even if they were a cruel, mean person who did things that normally society would find repulsive, such as rape or child molestation, since there's no judgment on anything and nothing is right or wrong, then, of course, they would just die and go into this God. So at any point in time, this God is made up of or composed of these individuals who committed these things, who have melded and become part of the essence of God for a while before they go back out. I mean, it's really even in New Age terms, and the New Age does not value logic at all. In fact, they downgrade logic. But even in New Age context, this is highly illogical. There's just no way to understand it or to accept it comfortably, I think, even for people who aren't Christians. Yet people are accepting it, I think, because there's an idea that there is no judgment. So you ultimately really aren't accountable, and you're God, so this kind of elevates you to a higher status than just a regular old human being, and you have this sort of ultimate goal of going back to this God. I don't know. You know, I'm a little actually surprised that this book is as popular as it is. I'm not surprised that it's popular and sold well, but the fact that people are using it as a study guide for their spiritual journey, and they're ignoring the incredible implications of what is said in here bothers me. I think people have just become more desensitized to truth.
Well, do you think it might have something to do, and you've mentioned this several times here, one of your basic critiques is the logical inconsistency, and you just mentioned that the New Age movement tends to denigrate logic and inconsistency. In fact, the less logical, less consistent you are, the more profound you sound. Do you think that's part of the appeal here, that culturally, at least here in America, when something sounds logically inconsistent, when something sounds like nonsense, people tend to label that as spiritual?
Yeah, I think that could be part of it. The fact that logically a lot of things in these books don't make sense is okay because it's a spiritual truth, and therefore logically we may not be able to understand it, or it may even sound silly. And yeah, in that kind of context, the books would be more acceptable. And the idea that it's illogical really doesn't matter because, you know, it's just, it's spiritual, and it's, if this feels right, then it's true. So it all depends on how it feels. So I tend to, when I talk to people who like these books, I try not to use the word logic or logical. I try not to say this is illogical because they don't really care if I think it's illogical. You know, I try to talk about the implications. I'll say, but what are the implications of this? And then I would, you know, try to think of an example. Like, well, I guess we can't say anything Hitler did was wrong. Or I guess we can't say that rape is wrong. And pick something that you know the person is going to be bothered by. And most people are not going to say, sure, rape is fine. So you pick something really horrendous and say, how can we condemn this if we go by what this God says? You know, and that, I try to say things like that to get them to see what he is really saying here and what the implications of it are.
What do you think? I mean, you've come out of astrology. You've come out of the New Age movement. from the inside out, what do you think is really happening here with Neil Donald Walsh? Is he simply perpetrating an elaborate ruse in the publishing world and duping a lot of people, or does he actually believe that he's having conversations with the deity?
Okay, I have two answers that are not opposite, they're compatible to that question. The first answer is, I think it's very hard to tell whether someone is believing what they're doing or if they're trying to deceive others. I think that's a very hard question to ask about, you know, anybody doing this kind of thing. So I think it's impossible to know for sure. Number two, my own personal opinion is that he does believe it. I believe it's in Friendship with God in the beginning of that book. He talks about his background, and he has a very strong New Age background. He had a lot of contact with New Age people, was in New Age seminars. He absorbed a lot of New Age ideas for years and years and years, just as I did. And so considering that background, it makes a lot of sense to me that this would just be a perfect consequence to that, and that he really would feel that this was God. I do believe it's possible he is channeling some sort of demonic entity. Because I personally don't think that he could come up with all these things. I just don't think that. That's my own opinion. It's nothing I can prove. That's just my own view.
Marcia Montenegro, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Marcia Montenegro is a former astrologist, and she's founder of Christian Answers for the New Age, based in Arlington, Virginia. You can check out their website by going to our website at issuesetc.org. Go to the link with links with regular guests section, and you will find a direct link to Marcia Montenegro and Christian Answers for the New Age. The website address again is issuesetc.org. We do not have to speculate as to who God is or might be. God has made it very clear who he is. He's revealed it in one way, and that is through the incarnation of his Son. And in Jesus Christ, we find God revealed in his fullness, all of his fullness. Is God still a mystery? Of course, but he's a mystery revealed in the flesh, in Christ crucified for the sins of the world. That's how we know who God is. God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who purposed from all eternity to redeem us with the blood of his incarnate Son, Jesus Christ. And who has left no doubt as to what he thinks of us. What does he think of us? We're rotten sinners who need him and cannot save ourselves. He does care what we do. He cares deeply what we do. But what we do earns his wrath. And the only thing that has earned his favor is the shed blood of Jesus Christ on the cross. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.